stars live here.
Are you ready?
On air. Online.
You ready to have a good time?
On your smart speaker and wherever you stream. Broadcasting from Montreal and around the world.
The Jeremy White Show, available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now.
Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
My next guest is going to be bringing his absolutely incredible three-hour extravaganza Interstellar Sky Guitar Tour to the Fairmont Theater in Montreal on May 8th. Tickets are on sale now at Venco.ca. Make sure you go and check it out because this show is going to be absolutely brilliant, man. If you've never gotten to see this next guest live before, this is probably the way to do it because I'm just seeing tons of amazing reviews online. Footage as well. It's so good. Make sure you go and check it out. Welcome to the show for the first time. The one, the only, the legend himself, Mr. Uli John Roth. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We have an off day in Syracuse, New York, and The sun is shining, and it's all good.
Nice. Syracuse is just a beautiful town, man. A beautiful city. I have a lot of friends that are out there playing lacrosse, actually. So,
oh, yeah?
I've been down there a couple of times in the last couple of years. So, beautiful city.
Well, we're on the outskirts. I haven't actually seen the city.
Come on. You got to get out of the outskirts. Get into the town.
I don't have any time, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm constantly working. I've got a schedule, you know. So, sometimes I have time, but today, not so much.
Talk a little bit about that. I mean, the touring schedule, it must be excruciating because not only are you doing this three-hour show, but during the day, I mean, like fans, like I just said, you should be out there exploring the town, getting out there. But in reality, you know, it's before the show. Do you really want to do anything?
Actually, I do love exploring towns. You know, I love walking. And on this tour, I've only managed to do it like once or twice. Mm. New York. We had an off day. Well, we had a mini residency in New York two nights in a row, you know. Heavenly bliss. So the next morning, I got up, walked all the way through Central Park to the Metropolitan Museum and the Dakota House, like a proper tourist.
Tourist, right.
New York is always a trip, and I've been there quite often, but it never ceases to amaze me. So, yeah, that was literally the only one, you know, and I got a sunburn because I didn't wear my hat, you know, so that was cool.
I learned that the hard way one year. I was sitting out on a patio or a terrace in Montreal, and I didn't have any sunblock on or anything. I wasn't wearing a hat, and it was a cloudy day. I'm like, I'm not gonna get a sunburn. No. Even on a cloudy day, you can get a sunburn. Like, you forget about that.
It can happen. Yeah.
Talking about the Dakota, were you a big Beatles fan?
Oh yeah. I mean, John Lennon. When I was young, you know, I loved his voice and everything, and I still do. Now I guess I gravitate a little bit more towards Paul McCartney, but they were like, you know, two peas in a pod, as we say in England, and an incredible songwriting team. And I think I learned a lot about music by being a Beatles fan before I even started playing, you know, because they were just so gifted in terms of harmony, melody above all, and doing things slightly differently. They knew how to get it right, you know. So, yeah, I got a really good grounding, I think, because of them.
I mean, I think that they were quite the innovators in the sense they were doing stuff way before anybody else did. I mean, they were the originators of so many different recording techniques.
They were really a bunch of geniuses, and that doesn't happen often in popular music. And also it was that time, you know, the early 60s was ripe with creativity, and the late 60s and the early 70s, you know. So, they came just at the right time doing the right thing, and it had a huge worldwide impact.
Who was the better guitar player, George Harrison or Keith Richards?
George Harrison.
Right?
Of course, yeah. Keith Richards is a great songwriter. He wrote all these He wrote, I think all the, well, most of the Stones hits, if I'm not mistaken.
No,
You
right.
know, the Stones specialist, but to do anything like Painted Black and so, that's quite something, you know, to write a song like that. But George Harrison was the absolute icing on the cake for the Beatles. You know, they that he gave them an edge which even their brilliant compositions otherwise wouldn't have had, you know. And so later on he became a great songwriter in his own right. But no, he was fabulous. He always played the right thing at the right time, you know, and not many people can do that.
Right, yeah, a lot of people.
So sorely missed. He was also very, I think, a very important figure in popular culture because he spoke his mind. He had unusual ideas. He was the one who brought Ravi Shankar and the Indian music with the sitar to the Western public, really, more than anybody. I mean, Yehudi Menuhin did this, but he was in the classical field. George Harrison has a lot to answer for, you
Yeah.
know. Most of it very good, I think.
No, completely. I mean, he was just such a unique musician in the sense that, like I said, you
Unique
know.
is the word, really, you know, multifaceted. And he never put himself above the music. He always was a servant of the music, which I love this kind of attitude.
Right. Yeah.
Because not everybody follows that
Was he an
paradigm.
influence on your playing?
Oh, well, I guess, you know, I mean, you know, these Beatles riffs that he came up with, you know, sometimes only three or four notes, you know.
Yeah.
And it sticks in your mind, and it makes you wonder how you can do so much with just simplicity, which is not an easy thing to do, you know.
Yeah, the old saying, less is more, it really does
Yeah,
make sense.
very often that's true, you know, although a certain gentleman from Sweden might disagree. And he's also right sometimes. Sometimes more is more. You know, you just got to know when.
Yeah, let's be honest though, you know, Mr. Sweden himself, he does say a lot of things out of pocket sometimes, so
Oh yeah, he loves being outrageous. Yeah.
are you a fan of that type of playing? I mean, like Shredtastic, like, you know, like Yngwie, like those players, or, I mean, we're
Well,
talking about George Harrison. I mean, it's.
Yngwie is a fantastic player. Always has been, but when it comes to shredding, first of all, I really have an issue with the word shredding. It's like the least musical musical description anybody could come up with, and sometimes it's very justified because a lot of these guys, once they know their arpeggios up and down the fretboards, they are actually shredding the music to pieces, you know, and I can't stand it. I prefer slow melodic playing. You know, I don't mind fast, but it needs to be melodic and meaningful. If there's no meaning behind it, forget it, you know. And with George Harrison, whether it was technically perfect or not, every note had a meaning. And every note hit you in the center line. You know, that's something that shredders normally don't know how to do.
Right.
Maybe they don't want to or so, but they're so removed from that. And so I don't consider myself a shredder, although some people say, hey, you're the father of it, you know, but that's just bull, you know, because yeah, Sales of Sharon, when I came up with that was fast, and some people would say it's shredding, but to me it's not shredding, it's just flamenco fast runs that are melodic, you know. So anyways.
No, but that makes sense though. I mean, when you approach the shredding side from a melodic aspect of it, I think that when you're able to, you know, I forget, I think it was Neil Sean that I interviewed, and he told me that, you know, they would call them front row licks. So in Journey, it's like, you know, if the chicks in the front row couldn't sing your solos, then what was the point of doing it?
Well, I have to say, I don't think that way. I don't think of it about the chicks in the front row. And I've never tried to give my music to impress females or males, you know? Yeah. I mean, it is what it is, you know?
Oh, come on. You're telling me you're not doing those solos to show off, Uli. Come on.
No, I don't. I really don't.
Talking about that, no, I mean, you know, if you go back to the infancy of that.
It's not the way my mind works, actually. To me, music is something actually very sacred and almost holy. So when I take a guitar and to the hands, I mean business. It's serious.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do it just casual. And no, I give it my all. And I treat it with the utmost respect.
Right.
So showing is really anathema to me in terms of music, you know. A little bit of humor, yes. I have humor, and sometimes you can play goofy things for the sake of it.
Totally.
But I really dislike showing off in any respect, like posing on stage in a weird way or like all that. No, it's not my kind of scene.
The showboating thing, it's sort of, no, like you said, you know, you're a serious musician and you take pride in what you're playing.
That's not for me.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, when we go back and look at the infancy of, like, you know, like shred guitar, for example, I mean, a lot of people would kind of credit you as one of the original guys that were playing, you know, fast, you know, flamenco style, you know, neoclassical style solos. Where did that sort of come from? I mean, if you're going to be playing, you know, rock guitar, I mean, there was a certain style at the time, but then Scorpions are coming out. I mean, between you and Shankar, it's like, you really didn't hear that style guitar playing. And I mean, where did that come from?
Michael and I, we had similar influences in the early days of electric guitar playing, and it shows, you know. We're both coming mainly from the melodic angle, and he's got a very superior sense of melody, which shows whenever he picks up the guitar, you know. And so melody is at the forefront. However, when I discovered classical music for myself, which was in my early teens, I realized that it wasn't just melody that I found attractive. I found the whole package attractive, and classical music is so advanced because it's got like 400 years of tradition, unbroken tradition. And the virtuoso, the so-called virtuoso aspect, is also an important aspect. To be able to play cascading notes, you know, flurries of notes that sound like waterfalls or, you know, volcanic eruptions or whatever, you need a certain amount of technique to do that, you know. And in classical music, that's a given. Even kids, they learn these fast arpeggios, the fast scales. In rock music, when I was there, that was not the case. 99% of players, 99.999 probably percent of players, were kind of beholden to the blues way of thinking. Blues rock, meaning you play pentatonic, not even scales, you pentatonic riffs or licks, and that is the vocabulary, or was the vocabulary. You know, very few players extended, went beyond that. Jan Akkerman was one of them in Focus. He started to integrate a lot of strange chromatic stuff. There was, of course, Alan Holdsworth, who was revolutionary in his approach. But most players were not like that, you know. And since I came from Germany, which has a strong classical background, it was kind of natural. I soaked all that up, you know. I started to study the piano, later on the violin, and I then thought to myself, well, why shouldn't I bring the same kind of technical approach and know-how and level to the electric guitar that these guys have been doing for centuries, you know? on their violins. And that was really, you know, the defining thought, you know, instead of doing a one octave arpeggio, you start doing two octave arpeggios, or even three, which on the guitar is a tall order on the standard guitar, you know, and then you have to find ways of doing that. And that's really how it happened. You know, I was exploring the technical resources of the guitar, but I was always faithful to the melodic and logical angle. You know, I don't believe in chaotic playing. I believe in intensely emotional playing, yes, but there needs to be a melodic structure behind it that even, as you say, the chicks in the front row can understand and, you know, and gravitate to. So that was it, you know. And also I noticed one thing, that certain players, and again, it was only a handful of these, were actually, when they played, their solos were not just, you know, somebody jamming. There was more to it. There was a meaning and a storyline attached almost. And these players were, above all, Eric Clapton, in his early days, with Cream, you know, a guitar lead like Sunshine of Your Love is phenomenally well constructed and just one in a million, complete one off. Or I'm So Glad, and so many of his, Swalabra, Sweet Wine. And I realized that most players were not doing that, but he was. And later on, Jimi Hendrix did exactly the same thing. You know, a guitar lead of Axis Builder's Love is not an accident. You know, it's just a fantastic way of ending the song, which was in itself a complete masterpiece of harmonic construction and totally unusual. There is no other song like that. Hendrix wrote several of songs which were completely unique. And so that's, once I realized that's what I want to do, is make sure that each guitar solo is unique and stands on its own feet while at the same time supporting the song. It should never destroy the song. It shouldn't be like an alien factor. It should actually lift up the song an octave into cyberspace and then go down again. It's like you tell a story and then you look up and say, oh, what are these birds in the sky doing and how do they relate to that message of that song, you know? So that's all, you know?
Yeah, it should be a continuation and add to the story as opposed to being its own chapter, its own side quest in the end.
Well, what I mean is this. The difference is this, with somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, they come to have a certain expertise and then they imprint their guitar lead onto any kind of song. Mm-hmm. It might be a decent guitar lead, but it might be completely wrong for this piece of music. And right. That's what I mean. If you're a servant of the music, you'll never do that. So George Harrison, good example again. Never did that. He always served the music, you know?
Yeah.
And what I mean, you know?
Talk a little bit about the gear you were using at the time. I mean, was there any limitations in technology in trying to execute that sound or execute that playing that you were going for?
Well, there were a lot of limitations, but I kind of worked with the limitations that were there. You know, we didn't have that much back then. There were no sophisticated overdrive pedals. There was a very unsophisticated fuzz phase, which I only use. Well, that's kind of like the sound of Satisfaction, or the sound that Jimmy used in maybe certain tracks. I'm not sure actually where he now used it, you know. But Purple Haze, for instance, definitely in the intro. Mm-hmm. But I only used the fuzz phase ever for like heavy duty dive bombs and destructive moments, because it sounded quite ugly. I mean, it was pushing the amp to the outer limit of what it could do. And I never used it for actual lead playing because the tone was not pretty enough, I thought, you know.
Right.
So all we had was a wah-wah pedal, an amp which you crank to 11 because that's the only way you could make it sing, and the guitar, you know. And later on, maybe an Echoplex or a Roland Echo or a tape echo.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it. There were some effects, you know, but I always used the effects really just as effects for in order to create atmospheres. For my lead playing, I hardly ever used effects. That was very, very rare, other than the wah-wah.
Even like pickup wise, I mean, like, would you have difficulty, getting certain notes out with like the pickups that you were using, or?
Well, I was using standard single coil Strat pickups from
Right.
a standard Strat, which we bought in Hamburg in 1975. There was nothing so special about it, other than I remember my Strat, the bridge pickup was quite powerful, and I always used to have extremely high action, and that pushed the pickup on the very close to it, and that was my favorite go-to sound because it was the most singing tone, you know. But it was also quite brutal when he was standing in front of the amp with 100 watts. We called it the death ray. You know, I've
Yeah.
been many a little club.
Just uncontrollable, I bet.
Was hard to control, you know. Nowadays, if you give that to a young player who's used to high gain amps, so they would run a mile, they would not know what to do with a thing like this. It's like you're trying to control a tiger in a closed environment, and all you have is a little plectrum. You know, it's not easy, and sometimes the results weren't that great, you know. But when, you know, most of the time, once you knew what you're doing, you could get great results. Because I had this very high action, the guitar was almost unplayable, I remember. And it was quite often also a little out of tune because of that. But what it did give me, it gave me the ability to really lay into the string with my right hand and really put a lot of energy into the strings. Whereas if you have, like, most players nowadays, they've got very low action, so they can play fast and comfortable. That way, the string collapses and you don't really get that tone, you know. And on an old school amp, if you don't put enough energy into it, it will give you nothing. It'll just give you a pretty ugly noise, you know. So you have to really shape the sound with your fingers, you know. And I still do, actually. I'm still playing these very unforgiving amps on stage in my rock gig.
Well, it's funny you say that because I'm friends with Nathan James, who's done a bunch of shows with you over the years, and
Oh, yeah.
he said
He's
he still
great.
he maintains that you have the loudest stage that he's ever played on ever.
Sure. That was true during the period when he was there. But then again, he's young and he hasn't been with people like Robin Trower or Jimi Hendrix, or I mean, back then everybody was loud, you know. It's just that I retained that volume level because I wanted the original sound. And in a big hall, that doesn't matter. In a club, it's sometimes just too much. Nowadays, I'm playing quieter, and we're always shielding our amps, you know, with plexi in front. So it's much more civilized now. But the Boeing 747 days, yeah, he experienced that, you know. But I tell you, I've had jams with people who were louder than me, and they blew me off the stage. Robin Trower was one of them. I couldn't believe it. He was quite something.
Well, I love the stories of Eddie Van Halen back in the day playing the clubs, and like, he'd literally put an
Oh,
insulation in
yeah.
front of his cabinets just to, because he felt bad for the people in the front row, just cranked all the way to 11.
Yeah. I know the feeling. I know the feeling. Yeah. But nowadays we don't get any more complaints, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, as I said, I'm civilized now in my old age, and Jason, and I find ways of still getting the sound. But back then I didn't know how to do it.
Speaking of Eddie Van Halen, I find a couple of those early Scorpions records were quite influential in his playing, because you hear him making like cool sound effects, you know, like in the intro of Everybody Wants Some. And what did you think of Eddie when he came out and hit the scene?
You know, it may sound a little weird, but it did pass me by, because that was the time when I left the Scorpions, mm-hmm. and I put the entire rock thing kind of behind me at that moment. You know, I just didn't listen to anything. I heard of him, and I thought his tapping was really impressive, you know, but I never did listen to any of the albums, because it was not my kind of music. It was too much a little bit like happy entertainment kind of stuff, you know. Great guitar playing, but then I was never really interested in great guitar playing if the other stuff wasn't there, you know. So it just wasn't my world. And I didn't really check it out, you know. That's just it, you know. But I do know that they were influenced, and they did, before they were famous, they played several of our songs. I think they played Catch a Train, and you can hear it. They did a little of these licks. That's Catch a Train, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got those licks from Brahms. Violin concerto, you know.
Goes back to classical.
There's nothing new under the sun, you know.
yeah it's like, you know, there's 12 notes. It's a matter of what you do with them, right?
Yeah, well, I guess so. Yeah.
With all the talk about George Harrison and the Beatles, I've always been curious about this. I mean, you sang on a few early Scorps albums, I mean, like Dark Lady, Hellcat, Sun in My Hand. Rudolph sang They Need a Million. Was Klaus always supposed to be the singer, or did you want to be more like the Beatles, where everyone gets a chance to sing and have their turn around?
No. We were not thinking about being like the Beatles. Klaus and I were Beatles fans, and you can hear it in his harmonies. Mm-hmm. And his, yeah, absolutely. But the Scorpions, really, that was a different world. You know, Klaus was undoubtedly the singer. I was only there. Sometimes it was good for Klaus not to have to sing the whole gig. Also, don't forget, he sang all these high notes, and like Catch a Train, this is just a killer for anybody's voice, you know. And so he always welcomed the fact when I took over and did a couple of songs without him, so it gave his voice some rest. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I was aware that I was a lousy singer, but part of the blame for me singing these songs goes to our producer, Dieter Dierks, who, when I brought a song like, say, Polar Nights or Dark Lady, as you mentioned, and we recorded with Klaus, and Dieter said, no, you have to sing that one. It is more in tune with the piece. Wow. And then Klaus just came in and did like the cream on top, you know. You know, I can't even go that high,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
But he did, like a question answer thing. So it was Dieter Dierks who said, your voice is not good, but unique. And he was right. It was not good, but it was unique. You can recognize it by a mile. Rudolph's is even more unique and even much worse than mine. So in the beginning, Rudolph thought that him and me could be the lead singers, you know, and that was actually totally ridiculous. And I said, no, we need Klaus Meiner. Please call him up. And at first Rudolph said, yeah, Klaus doesn't want to do music anymore, you know, but I kept insisting, bring Klaus to the rehearsals, and he did. And then as soon as Klaus saw what was going on, he was right there, and he was the Scorpions lead singer, you know, the only one they should have ever had, and the only one they ever had. And that was that, you know.
Yeah, and the rest is history, right?
The rest is history. Yeah, I mean, even for Electric Sun, I got a lot of flack because of my singing on The Firewind, which is deservedly so, because it is quite weird in places and over the top. But originally, I was looking for a singer for Electric Sun. I just couldn't find anybody because the tunes didn't lend themselves to real quote unquote singing. It was more like bards, bluesy kind of stuff, you know? And I actually didn't find anybody. And then time ran out, and we had all the album book, the studio book. So I did get to sing, you know? Years later, my voice got better because I actually started to work on it, which in the olden days I never did. And now I can sing a lot better. I can sing in tune and everything, and I can do the vibrato and I have a good falsetto. But I'll never have the vocal cords of a lead singer. You know,
Right.
that is something you're born with. Klaus has that. You know, Nathan James has that.
What did you do to get your voice to that point where you can sing better?
What?
What did you do for your voice to get to
Oh,
the
you know
point where it's
what?
better?
Well, like during the Electric Sun days, when people often always said, "Oh, yeah, this is the worst voice on earth with the most beautiful,"
They were that
they
critical?
had a point. I got that. I got that a lot, you know. And I figured they had a point. You know, I'm playing guitar like that, and then my voice is just like almost the opposite. There was a certain charm to it, and then some songs I think it actually did work, you know, but there were some where it was questionable. So I was talented to learn any instrument really quickly, just like that. But with the voice, not so. It was kind of not something that came natural to me. I needed a door opener. So I went to a classical singer, opera soprano, Elizabeth Mackenzie, and she had a beautiful voice, and she was a very gifted teacher. So she started me off on some Schubert songs and then Puccini and so, and she awakened my voice, and then I learned to sing like an opera singer, you know. At least I can produce the tones if I have to, and then I started understanding about the voice fully. And then I started writing for the voice in a way that a real lead singer could sing. Whereas before, in the Scorpions, that was not the case. I was more a natural born instrumentalist, you know. So that was that. Thanks to this lady, I learned how to sing, you know. And and now in my set, I'm singing lead on several tracks, even more demanding ones, and I haven't had any complaints during this tour, actually.
Cops
Whereas
haven't come
before,
shut down the show yet, so that's good.
maybe they've just given up.
Right.
That can be the case, you know. So whatever, I do what I do, and you know, it's horses for courses, you know. If I had a voice like Pavarotti, you know, I'd be in Carnegie Hall 7 days a week, you know. So,
that's very true. Not
you know,
everybody can have that, you know. It's very difficult to maintain on top of
it's
it.
a gift, you know. What Klaus Meine has is a gift, as a special gift, and I believe you're pretty much born with it, you know. I mean, Liz Vandal has that. She's on my Under a Dark Sky album, you know. When she sings a song like A Bridge to Heaven or so, I mean, it's just unbelievable. There's some people, and she is one of them, the PA loves them. They open their mouth, the engineer doesn't need any EQ. With me, they always have to do the mid and this, you know, to make it ring. And like with a voice like that, you know, you just sing and it resonates, and the PA loves you know.
They just have
So,
so much control.
well, it's not just that, it's a certain color of tone, which just is, well, that's just the singer's voice. That's it, you know. That's it.
Good singer,
The
good
great singers
microphone.
have that. The great singers have that, you know. Although some people might argue that Bob Dylan is a great singer, and I happen to be one of them. You know, I think he's a fantastic singer, actually, with an incredible way of shaping the words, incredible phrasing, and pure storytelling in his voice. But does he have like a singer's voice like Klaus Meine? Of course not.
Yeah.
It's not pretty, you know, and but it's not designed to be pretty, because some of the things he says are not pretty either, you know. So it's actually very much in keeping what he does. So you could talk about these things for a long time, you know, and look at them from certain angles, you know. Then you listen to Pavarotti and compare him to a rock singer. There are some rock singers that also have a $1 million voice and they can do amazing things, you know. But when you listen to Pavarotti sing Nessun Dorma, time stands still. It just doesn't get any better in terms of tone and sheer beauty of projection, for me at least, you know. And then it's just melting point. Rock singers hardly ever do that to me. They can do other things, you know, but the sheer beauty of tone production is just unbelievable. And I listen to that, and I try to emulate that on the guitar. Like, for instance, Placido Domingo. Also, beautiful tenor voice. Nowadays, I mean, the rock people probably won't know him, but when I first had my singing lessons, I started listening to E Luce Van Le Stelle, beautiful aria by Puccini, and he sang that fantastically. So I emulated that on the guitar and recorded it, you know, and it's on my prologue to the Symphonic Legends. So I've learned a lot from listening to these kind of sounds and interpretations. Yeah. I can't hear what you're saying. Your tone is gone.
We go. Now can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was black magic for a second. You know, we're talking about voices and then you lose your voice.
My voice is gone.
How about it, huh?
That's amazing. I was just saying that it's incredibly inspiring to hear you talk about that. It makes me want to go and discover this music myself. It's like I've never actually gone and done a deep dive.
You don't know what you're missing. And I'm not talking about the big operas as such, because I personally am not actually an opera fan. I find it sometimes a little bit long in the tooth. But back then, that was their way of having the grand, the grand TV gala or whatever, you know. But within these operas, you get some beautiful pieces, some of them, and they stand alone, just like a song, you know. And this is one of them, probably the most amazing melody ever written in my book. And and somebody like Pavarotti just absolutely nails it and makes it just as beautiful as it can be, you know. And that's a treasure. Something like that is a treasure. If you're a rock fan, then I say, how about if you just open your mind, forget about all the preconceptions of what it should sound like, just be there like a child and listen with open ears and let it really go deep down into your heart. And then the sky's the limit.
Yeah. No, absolutely. This was a really, really fun chat. I feel really good after this.
Oh boy, what can I say?
Go check out Uli Jeanroth performing live.
You know, you were asking the questions. I'm just following your lead, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I want to go back and listen to some of this stuff. I mean, like, it's like, yeah, first of all, you have access to everything online these days.
I'll tell you what it is, because you asked the question, well, how did you come up with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the answer is, it's because I'm rooted in this deep tradition of 400 years of amazing music that there is, you know, of classical music and ethnic music. And, of course, I've got one foot also in the rock genre, which comes from the blues and early rock and roll, etc., and then was transcended, you know, and took on new forms in the 70s and 80s, you know, and maybe also to some degree in the 90s. So that's why, you know, arc of where it's all coming from.
It all comes together. It all comes full circle. I'm just looking at the tour dates. Tomorrow night, you're performing in Syracuse, New York at Sharky's. Saturday night, Canandaigua, New York at the Fort Hills Theater. Then coming up to Canada, May 7th, Quebec City in the Imperial Bell, Montreal, Canada on Wednesday. May 8th at the Fairmont Theater. Some tickets are still available for that. Going to be hitting Ottawa, Toronto. Lots of great tour dates and fantastic venues as well to see Uli John Roth. So go out of your way. Go and try and check out this tour. It's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, just looking at the highlights online and after this conversation, like, I want to go. I'm on vacation next week. I'm going to be out of the country, so I can't even come to see you now, which is so disappointing. But next time around, I guess I'm going to have to go. I want to see the...
I'm always coming back to Canada.
Yeah, you know? I want to see the Excalibur. I want to see the Mighty Wing next time, you know?
Yeah.
I love that. Well, Uli, it was fantastic to chat with you. Best of luck on the rest of this tour, and thanks a lot for coming on the show. Appreciate it. You have to come back, and we'll talk more guitars.
Having me, and you're very welcome anytime. All right.
The Jeremy White Show.
Get exclusive interviews and bonus content on demand now. Visit youtube.com/Jeremy White Show.